winter storm threats will absolutely bring you to your knees.
We're being held to a higher accountability now. These models are out there for everybody to see on the internet.
They taught us in the National Weather Service that flip-flopping was one of the worst things we could do that would confuse the public, so I think we're reluctant to change.
We will ignore a model run that doesn't agree with what we're doing, or at least be kind of slow to notice it.
As I've gotten older, I've realized how much we don't know.
I felt like growing up that I lived in a weather void, and you literally were watching your temperature, to see what would happen.
Welcome to the second edition of Weather Brains, the program about weather by weather geeks. I'm David Black from Birmingham, Alabama, on behalf of the Weather Company, saying a hello to you and a hello to one of our primary members tonight, James Spann, chief meteorologist with the ABC television affiliate in Birmingham, Alabama. Hello, James.
Hello, David. How are you?
We're doing super tonight. I want to talk to you about some weather forecasting issues, but before we get into that, let's introduce the rest of the crew. Let me let you do that, James.
Okay, I can do that. We have on with us for the first part of the podcast this week, the legendary John Olshue.
Woo-hoo.
John, this is your first time on Weather Brains. Welcome.
Yes, it is. Thanks for having me, and I look forward to our topic tonight, one of my favorites.
I'm expecting some expertise from you, John.
What type of expertise?
Eating? To be determined.
Okay.
Now, John, you didn't get a chance to tell us about yourself. You weren't with us last week, so
I'm
have
sorry.
To go in there and say a few words about yourself now.
Sure. My name's John Olshue. I work with James Spann in the ABC 3340 Weather Department, and I am the weekend meteorologist and have been with James for 9 years now, and actually was an intern before that with him, so it's probably been over 10 years that we've known each other and been working together, and I'm just happy to be here tonight.
Well, great. Thanks for joining us, John. And David, we have another first-timer tonight.
We sure do, James. Tell me a little bit about Jason Simpson. Where did you run into Jason first off, James?
Well, Jason was an intern here, and he's one of these bright, smart kids. I like interns that are smarter than me because I can learn something from them. And he looped through here in the late 90s, and we had an opening here a couple of years ago, and hired young man Jason at a young age. In fact, we don't think Jason is shaving yet, but one of these years that'll start. So, Jason, tell us about yourself.
Oh, well, thanks, James. I appreciate that introduction.
Notice how he talks like a radio man
yes,
now.
He does. Yeah,
he
hello,
does.
Jason.
Yes.
I learned from the best.
You get the big bucks.
See, look, this guy's from Holly Pond, Alabama. That radio talk business won't fool us. We know where he's from.
What would you like me to say in my Coleman County dialect?
Everybody in Coleman County's on to you, Jason.
I actually have a tape that none of you will ever get your hands on from me as an intern in 1999. And there's a big difference in the voice now and the voice then. It took a long time to get rid of that southern accent. I still like to hang on to the country, though. I like that.
Tell us about yourself, Jason.
Oh, introduce myself. What is there to say that you haven't already said? Of course, today on J.B. Elliott's blog post, he said I looked like I was 16 years old on television. I'm actually in my mid-20s, so I'm a little bit older than that. I consider it a real blessing to be able to work with you guys. Of course, I work with you, James, and with John and Brian Peters in the ABC 3340 Weather Office. I've been working there since the first day of January of last year. So this first year, it's been great. And I look forward to many, many more working here in Birmingham.
Did you get the paycheck crisis straightened out, Jason? They started paying you now, finally?
They did. Actually, yes, they did.
Okay. And who else have we with us tonight, James?
I do believe the legend of weather in the Southeast United States is on here, J.B. Elliott. J.B., how are you?
I'm fine, but I've never heard that title before, but I appreciate it. I'm doing good. Sitting here enjoying listening to you guys.
And I listened to last week's podcast, and there's no doubt I talked way too much. So, David, my goal tonight is to shut up and listen and speak sparingly. But we want to talk about winter storm forecasting, what's right with it, what's wrong with it, how the private sector does it, how the Weather Service does it. It's that time of year,
Understand. Something that I have really wanted to ask you guys, and all of you here are a really good mix for this, is directly about what James is mentioning, and that's the challenge in forecasting wintry weather for various parts of the country. And I guess my simple question to you, James, and whoever else wants to talk about this is, why is it that you guys have to waffle back and forth so much during the last 3, 4, 5 days before a particular forecast event? Why can't there be more consistency when you talk on Tuesday about what's going to come up on Saturday?
Well, I have a lot of thoughts on that, but I defer to J.B. Elliott. I mean, J.B.'s been doing this for a long time, since the 1950s, and he's the veteran here. So, J.B., how do you respond to that?
Well, snow forecasting is blown out of proportions because, as we know, the old simple rule, 1/10 of an inch of rain will produce 1 whole inch of snow. That's not always true. It depends on how much moisture is in the air and how cold and dry the air is, but it's just so easy to miss. We could forecast a light rain and get 20 hundredths, say, but if it were to fall as all snow, it would be 2 to 3 inches of snow. So the error is multiplied. And also, the borderline between snow and rain is so crucial, not only at the surface, but especially up in the lower 4 and 5,000 feet of the atmosphere, that just a slight 1 or 2 degrees change in temperature can make a whale of a difference, can be all rain versus all snow.
So why is there such a large margin of error then?
Well, back in the 80s, we forecast 3 inches for Birmingham based on a low-pressure area that was going to develop over the northwest gust, swing eastward south of Louisiana and come up through the southeast states, and we forecast 3 inches of snow for Birmingham. We almost got ran out of town because we didn't get a flake. However, Childersburg, just 50 air miles to the southeast, got the 3 inches of snow. That was a small mathematical percentage error in the track of the low-pressure area 3 days in advance, but that tiny error was enough to make the largest city in the state miss the snow altogether, and yet it came as close by as 50 miles.
I want to address something here, and I'm going to apply it to me, and it's something that we know as meteorologists that is called wish casting, and that is that if I, as a meteorologist, and like I said, I'm criticizing myself here, take a look at one run and then of a model, and then in the next run see something a little bit different because I want my forecast to be correct from that last run. Sometimes I won't adjust as quickly as I should, and I think with snow forecast, we sometimes do that, or at least I do that. And if you see what we call the magic line, which is the 540 line, which is kind of a measure of heights and how cold the upper parts of the atmosphere are, that sometimes if I see that 540 line move north, I'll be slow to adjust for that. And I kind of wish that at least me, when I was doing my forecast, it would hold to that rule, that if you've got those critical thickness values, 540 line's one of them. Another one we use is something called the 850 millibar zero isotherm, which is the freezing level at 850 millibars. If that is not in the area, if it has moved out of the area, we probably need to think about revising the forecast. And we had an incident here, for everybody that's living across the country, here in the southeast in Alabama, about this weekend, about 48 hours ago, where we had a snow forecast, or we were all looking at the possibility of snow, and it really became apparent before the snow was about to take place, or the forecasted snow was going to take place, that there might be some warming going on. And I think a lot of forecasters were slow to jump on that. Jason Simpson, I got to give him credit. He made a really good call when we were looking at that together during the morning hours, that it looked like that system had pulled a bunch of warm air into it, and looked at some of the balloon launches from downstream to see that, and he was right about that warm air nosing into it. But a lot of times we will ignore a model run that doesn't agree with what we're doing, or at least be kind of slow to notice it.
You know, John, in addition to that, we're being held to a higher accountability now because these models are out there for everybody to see on the internet. Everything that we look at on a daily basis is out there, and as a meteorologist, we have to separate ourselves from just looking at a model run and making a forecast on a model run and making a forecast based on what we know about the science of that model run. For instance, you talk about the warm air. Just to the south of that area of low pressure, the low was sitting on the Red River on Sunday afternoon. The high in Dallas on Sunday was in the upper 70s. In Oklahoma, it was in the 40s and 50s. That entire air mass was too warm, and when you have that much warm air surging into a cool air mass, and You know, for those of you who don't know a whole lot about how wintry weather happens, most of our winter precipitation here in the southeast is called overrunning. That's where warm air comes up over a cold air mass, and it tends to erode away that extreme southern extremity of that colder air mass. And when you have that much warm air, that kind of warmth like we saw over Texas headed north, it's going to take a lot of that cold air out, and that's exactly what we saw. It ended up with a very heavy rain across Metro Birmingham yesterday.
David, I want to ask Jason a question. You know, he's the young guy. You know, a whole new generation. You got these old guys like us. You know, our old rain-snow line, as John mentioned, you look at the freezing line about 5,000 feet off the ground. The zero line at 850, in other words. You look at the height between 1,000 and 500 millibars, where the height is 5,400 meters, the 540 line. That's the old way of doing it. What's the new way, your generation? You sharp guys, you got to have a better way. So what is it?
Well, I don't know necessarily it's a better way, other than we just, you know, we learned in college to manipulate the things that we know about the old ways a little bit better. Whereas you use a temperature threshold, we used mainly thickness thresholds. And again, if you're not very familiar with the different levels in the atmosphere, what we call the 850 millibar level, the 500 millibar level, those are roughly pressure heights in the atmosphere. 850 millibars, roughly, like you said, 5,000 feet high. And the lower the pressure goes, the higher you're getting in the atmosphere. So what we do is we take the thickness value between 850 millibars and 700 millibars. 850 and 500, 700 and 500, and then finally it's that 540, which is that critical thickness between 1,000 and 500 millibars. So we have more pressure thresholds, and we also use this thing called Buff Kit. I'm a really big fan of Buff Kit. What it does is it takes model data from the NAM, from the GFS, the NGM, and the RUC models, the Rapid Update Cycle models. And it allows you to see it in vertical profile form instead of looking at a straight map. And seeing that profile is a lot easier to determine a precipitation type that the model's forecasting as opposed to trying to look at it on a straight map. And those are some of the things that we use, and I really think that helps out, especially when it comes to making a call as to how much warm air is coming in or how much cold air, how dense the cold air is, how thick the cold air is. All those different factors play in. And, you know, of course, the deeper into the science of meteorology we go, and this is a very young science. It's very young compared to chemistry or physics. You know, these things have been worked out for ages. Meteorology, we're still working on. We're still working on it. So as we find more and more complexities, especially when it comes to winter weather in a lower latitude state like Alabama, it's going to get more and more complex 10 years from now, 20 years from now. I'm sure that students are going to come out of college with much more than just those critical thickness values and a program that manipulates the models.
I was just going to say, David, I think we ought to mention here that Jason mentioned Buff Kit. That's a free download. Anybody can download that program for free. Just go to Google or something and search out Buff Kit, BUFKIT, and I think it's called that because it was developed at the Buffalo National Weather Service office. And just download that, and you can load the data in from whatever site you're interested in, your local National Weather Service website. And I'll agree, that's a great program. Now, having said that, I've been burned a bunch on winter weather events with Buff Kit, but yet it's just another tool in the arsenal. So, JB, go ahead.
Backtracking to what John said a few minutes ago about not reacting immediately to a change in the model data, the succeeding model data, I think that's human nature, and I think I'm guilty of that too. And for one reason, they taught us in the National Weather Service or the U.S. Weather Bureau back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s that flip-flopping was one of the worst things we could do that would confuse the public. So I think we're reluctant to change sometimes because of that. At least I am.
Well, I've been in it on TV now for 9 years in this market that's very, very sensitive to snow forecast. If we had gone back and taken every snow forecast that we did and divided it by two, we would have been so much closer to what happened rather than, so maybe that's the thing. Maybe we have some type of correction in there that we divide accumulation totals by two. And, you know, it seems like every snow event we've had in recent memory, it hasn't been just a slam dunk. It's always been a close call. It's always been where the 540 line is drifting right over us or the 850 zero is right over us. And that has just been the bane of me trying to forecast this. It'd be nice to have the 540 line sitting down at Mobile, and there's no question that if we get any moisture in here, it's going to be snow. That would be just an easy forecast I'd love to see, but it just hasn't worked out like that lately.
Right. We need to carve out the state of Alabama and move it north about 400 miles.
Right.
It's easy to forecast snow in Minnesota, you know. Down here, it's a challenge.
Jason, we're going to say thanks to you. We know that you've got to run on. Thanks for being with us, and maybe we'll have you on another show with us real soon, like.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
Good deal. Okay, we'll be bringing aboard another member of our crew shortly, but in the meantime, John, let me ask you one question that sort of ties into this. I'm listening to you guys talking about the difficulties here of anticipating all these different meteorological scenarios. I've got a real elementary question that I want to ask nonetheless, and that is, how big of an issue is totally bogus data that gets into any of these models that would just throw you completely off? Is that just something that is a constant threat?
Well, I guess bogus goes both ways. You either have data that's bad or you have data that's non-existent. And I can't talk about the bad data, but let me talk about data that's non-existent. And when I say that, you know, we have upper air stations where people release balloons, mainly National Weather Service offices, and we get the data back from that. We feed those into models, that data into models, and it helps us understand what's happening and helps us forecast. What we don't have are good upper air data from Mexico and definitely out in the ocean, out in the Pacific. And it's funny that you bring that up. The internal discussion that's been going on today amongst the meteorologists, at least in our office, is, hey, there is a system that we can see easily on satellite sitting out in the Pacific. And the question is that going to be entrained on a polar front that's coming down this week and into this weekend and cause some type of snowstorm over us? The models tell us no. They say it's going to be too far south and not strong enough. But what we think the models may not know is what the upper air data and what the data is from out there in the Pacific where that storm is. So that's what worries me. The bogus data you can't do anything about, and to be honest with you, you probably wouldn't see it, but the data that's non-existent, that's the stuff that we wish was in there where we could get a better forecast.
Not a perfect world. Let's say hello to Bill Murray with the Weather Company joining us. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Weather Brains. How are y'all tonight?
I'm listening to some pretty good brains. You want to throw in anything on the difficulty of forecasting wintry precipitation?
Well, I'll tell you what. This weekend, some memories were coming back to me, David, about, you know, being a kid back in the old days when we, you know, literally all we had was a dial-up telephone number to get weather information, you know, because at night especially all the AM radio stations, you know, did broadcast. So literally, we were in a data void all the time. You know, John was just talking about this data void over the Pacific, but I felt like growing up that I lived in a weather void. And, you know, you literally were watching your temperature, you know, to see what would happen. The sky cover, you're making your own forecast. So now with all this information that we have, you know, we have a tremendous amount now available to us. It's really just incredible. You know, those forecasts are still extremely difficult.
James, if you are a forecaster in Denver, Colorado, is winter forecasting a totally different animal there?
Oh, yeah. There's no comparison out there. You got orographics and a whole different kind of set of dynamics with a different type of air mass and different type of storm, and you got the mountains to deal with. But let me just say this. You know, for the average person, and sometimes I think we're all struggling, is the person listening to this podcast a weather geek that understands all these terms, you know, the thickness values, and or I have this concern that some people might be listening that we're going way over their head. Let me just say this. One of the easiest ways to determine rain, snow is by looking at an upper air chart, and you go up to that 5,000-foot level. The easiest thing for somebody that's not really seriously into all this is just to look at that. Is it freezing 5,000 feet off the ground? If it is, if it's colder than freezing, you got a good chance it's going to snow. If it's not, good chance it's not going to snow. It might be freezing rain or just rain. And you get that from these upper air balloon reports. So many people, David, send in these, you know, they'll say, I've got 25 degrees. I know it's going to snow. We can have rain in 25. The key is what goes on above it. JB, go ahead.
And let's not forget that in an average snowstorm, the heavy snow band is only about 50 miles wide. So if you misproject the path of the low just a little bit, that can change the amount of heavy snow 50-mile-wide band, it can shift it north or south, and it can miss a major metropolitan area completely. Back in the late 40s, I believe, New York City had a major burst on a major bust on a major snowstorm that was forecast. They were expecting little or no snow, and they wound up with a major, major snowstorm. And you know, I think a congressional investigation ensued later.
I think that's actually this week in 1969, because forecasters were calling for, you know, light snow changing to rain, but a secondary low developed off the coast, and it really dumped a tremendous snowstorm, and actually threatened the political career of New York's Mayor Lindsay, because the city just was not prepared because of the poor forecast.
Yeah, I believe that was it. Yeah.
So, guys, are we getting better at forecasting this or not?
Not a great deal.
Yeah, I haven't seen any increase in skill, I'll have to be honest with you. I will tell you, I'll tell you one forecast we're glad didn't come true, and that was the one this past weekend. For you guys that are listening from around the nation, we had a snow forecast in place. We thought that the potential liquid precipitation that was coming out of that storm, the model was telling us, was probably anywhere between a half of an inch to three quarters of an inch, which would have been, you know, 2 or 3 inches. We got 3 inches of rain, which would have, if we'd have translated over to snow using a rough ratio of 10 to 1, you know, could have easily been 30 inches of snow. Now, a lot of times with heavy, wet snow, you don't use that ratio, but we could have been measuring it in feet instead of inches.
James, you get a fair amount of email in your position as the chief meteorologist for the ABC affiliate in Birmingham, Alabama. How much hate mail does a blown winter forecast generate?
You get hate mail if you're right. You get hate mail if you're wrong. You just get hate mail. Unfortunately, that's the world we live in. And I learned years ago, no matter what you say, you're going to make some people extremely angry. And part of the problem, I think, David, is that people get confused on what they hear and who says what. The way we do it, our little group is totally independent from anybody else. And, you know, somebody will send me an email and they heard this and it didn't happen. Well, you know, we don't base our weather forecast on what the Weather Service says or the Weather Channel or, you know, AccuWeather or Country Boy Eddie or the Three Stooges. I mean, it's all independent. So, and I'm not faulting everybody else. Everybody's got an opinion, and there's a great choice out there, and that's what people need to do. They need to determine who they trust and go get their weather information. But I guess what I'm trying to say, not all forecasts are the same. And the only thing I ask, and I don't mind getting the hate mail, it's just part of, you know, doing the weather on television. Before you fire a nasty piece of hate mail off, though, I'd like to ask, where'd that forecast come from that you heard? You know, this past weekend, I got a lot of nasty ones about the fact that it didn't snow in Birmingham. The line I drew was north of Birmingham. And you know, you can go back and read that. So I think that's part of the problem, too. And one of the topics I'd like to get into at some point, don't think we'd have time tonight, is this bewildering array of messages coming from the Weather Service. And I'm a professional. I don't understand what half that stuff means. You got these, you know, winter weather advisories and snow advisories and freezing rain warnings. And JB, you understand what all that stuff means? You used to work for the Weather Service.
Well, most of that has changed since I got out of the Weather Service in 1989. And there's a lot of the terminology used now that I do not fully understand. That's probably my fault. I should look it up. But I'm a little bit confused on the winter weather advisors and the snow advisors. And later, of course, it becomes heavy snow watch or heavy snow warning. And there's so many of those titles that I can imagine the public being confused.
Yeah, you know, I got a piece of hate mail from somebody from Tuscaloosa, and they apparently were under one of these messages. I don't know if you guys remember which one they were under this past weekend. One of those. And they were just fuming because they knew they were going to, you know, take off the day and we're going to have snow and not have to go to work or school. And I don't know anybody that forecasts snow for Tuscaloosa, but apparently
they issued a nowcast about 10 o'clock. James, it clearly said they were going to have an inch of snow in Tuscaloosa. And we were all looking at each other like, what?
Really?
It was very strange.
Well, in that case, it's just a disagreement then. You know, they thought that and we think something else. And sometimes we'll be wrong and they'll be right. I'm not pointing fingers, but I do think it would be good for all of us if there's a way that those messages could be simplified, maybe not so many of them, or we could understand what they mean. It's just a dizzying array of messages out there. But again, my main advice for people when it comes to winter weather forecasting, pick your source and stick with it. You know, don't get your weather information from the lady at the checkout line at the supermarket buying milk and bread. That's funny how, you know, rumors get started. But anyway, back to your original question, David. Hate mail, that's just a way of life.
Speaking of hate mail, even back in the 50s and 60s, we got hate mail. It wasn't email because there was no such thing as email. But we got wall-to-wall telephone calls the next day if we missed a snow forecast. Just wall-to-wall calls.
I think what I find rather ironic, guys, is the fact that we have more information available to us today than we've ever had in our lives, and yet there seems to be this pervasive confusion about the weather, particularly what's going to happen. Anybody agree with that?
I do, too. I think one of the problems, you got a whole lot of kids that are 15 and 16 and 17 years old, and like I think John mentioned, they can get these computer models, and they come out and spit out these forecasts on blogs and forums and all this, and people read that and think that's the deal. And you know, you read 80 opinions, and they're all different. I'll be honest with you. I think what cuts through all of this stuff is absolute experience. And you got some guy like JB that's been through, how many winter storms has JB been through? That is the best teacher beyond all this stuff, all the science and all the thickness values and all the freeze levels. I don't think you can beat experience because as I've gotten older, I've realized how much we don't know. Seems like the young kids coming out of school, they think they know it all. I'll say this, these winter storm threats will absolutely bring you to your knees. Wouldn't you agree, JB?
Well, that's for sure. That is a great statement.
I'm guessing, too, that you're typically caught a lot between the one extreme of trying to warn people that a certain event may happen and being perceived as being an alarmist at the same time. Is this just a danged if you do and danged if you don't?
One thing about it, if you try to explain that the forecast can change and the uncertainty of the forecast, people will accuse you of trying to cover your bases ahead of time, so you have to be careful with that, too. It's just so much in the mix that it's just a difficult situation.
James, at this point, what can people do just to try to keep the confusion out? Like you say, just pick a source and stick with it. Does that mean that they really need to know where that information's coming from, who's creating it?
Yeah, and look, I'm not trying to push our products. I think our blog is great. The popularity has exploded. We couldn't handle the traffic we were getting this past weekend on the internet. We had to go to a distributed database over a series of servers to scale the traffic coming in. And I appreciate that. But yeah, look at our products. If you don't like our stuff, go find somebody else. You know, go to the National Weather Service or go to some other forecasting firm. But I do think, and some people like to just poke around and see what different people are saying, and that's fine, but I do think you need to know where your information is coming from. When you say it right, John?
Yeah, you do. I don't know if this is popular among this group or would be popular among meteorologists, but I'll just say it. I have noticed the trend of snow forecasting and winter weather forecasting here in the Southeast that if you stay a little bit conservative with it, or maybe have a conservative mindset with it, you're going to be closer to right most times. And that's just me. Over the last 9 years of being brought to your knees, as you said, that if I had gone back in and been a little bit more conservative, you know, I sure would have won the forecasting contest.
So the bottom line is when somebody watches two or three different television stations, listens to a couple of different radio stations, and looks at what's in the newspaper for the coming weekend, you're likely to get anything, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And some people get mad about that. But you know what, David? You go to five doctors and have them look at some condition you have, and you probably might get five answers. And these are all physicians that went to medical school, and they're very smart, and they're good at what they do. And that's just the way it works here in the weather business. And I'll say this about John's comment. I'm like a bull in a I'm the bull in the china shop here in this group. I am not very conservative. I believe it's my job to tell people what I think is going to happen. And I think one of the things, I really get flustered. It just seems like a lot of people out there in the longer periods are so conservative, it's worthless. I wrote a blog post on this called Consensus or Accuracy. If you go and do a search on that, you can read that. But, you know, some people think you just need to forecast normal weather after 2 days. Highs in the 50s and lows in the 30s. For us here in the South, that's normal for this time of the year. And, you know, we rarely ever have normal weather. We just rarely have that. You go back and look at the numbers. I mean, it averages out to that, but that's not what we actually have. So in my effort to be accurate, sometimes I sure overshoot the curve, and I'm very guilty of being too aggressive sometimes. But on the other hand, I don't like that conservative game where you say every day the high is going to be in the 50s and every day the low is going to be in the 30s and it never snows, because you'll get burned that way. And we were lucky. We had a good call in the blizzard of 93 using the same techniques I'm using now. So I'm the bull in the china shop here.
I think that's fine, because the way James enshrouds it, he explains the possibilities that may go wrong, and he clearly states that it's not a sealed in stone forecast.
And with that note, James, for anybody who wants to contact us about winter forecasting or anything else, what's the best address for them to use via email?
I'll let Old Shoe answer that. Old Shoe is our email guy. He's the Weather Brains email officer, so John has set up some email addresses.
Yeah, hopefully this works now. Question@weatherbrains.com should get to us. Question or questions, either one. They both route to us, and send us your questions, and we'll try to answer them next week on Weather Brains.
Okay, guys, another great show. Thanks to all of you. If you'd like to contact us, our email address once again is question@weatherbrains.com. For James Spann, J.B. Elliott, Jason Simpson, John Oldshue, and Bill Murray, I'm David Black with the Weather Company from Birmingham, Alabama. We thank you for listening. We'll see you next time for more Weather Brains. Weather Brains is copyright 2006 by the Weather Company. All rights reserved.